Next up, the Q&A session from the lecture, The Future of Grizzlies and Wolves in Montana, by Drs. Chris Servine and Doug Smith, with moderator Todd Wilkinson, that was held at the Emerson Cultural Center on Friday, October 18th of 2024.
We're going to have a conversation now and talk about some of the stuff you heard. And Todd's going to moderate, and then we may have some questions from the audience, too.
That was excellent. So you spoke about people giving voice to animals, both of you guys. We read, I'm a member of the press, everybody here reads numbers of animals, and we get focused on numbers in the context of delisting. I want to ask each of you, and to start with Chris, could you perhaps explain the difference between political delisting and what you think true biological recovery of a species is, and maybe the gap between, so that we can all be clear that when people toss out numbers and say something is recovered, it may or may not be so.
Okay. Recovery and delisting are two different things. The objective of the Endangered Species Act is to get listed species to the point at which protection under the Act is no longer required. That's what the law says. Delisting would be when they're fully recovered and healthy. That management is then taken over by the states or whoever would be the managers. For wolves and bears, that would be the states. Recovery is fixing all the problems that the bears faced and the wolves faced. And as you could see through the presentations tonight, we haven't fixed all those problems at all. There's a lot of severe problems out there facing bears and wolves. And biologically, they are not recovered yet, either one of them. Recovery is not just numbers of animals on the landscape. It's the adequate regulatory mechanisms, and that wording is in the Endangered Species Act. There have to be adequate regulatory mechanisms in place so that when we pull the Endangered Species Act out from underneath these species, that they're healthy and they remain in good shape. And we're seeing what the states are doing right now is not adequate regulation of mortality, and therefore we are not ready to delist.
Well, I mean, I think wolves are similar, and certainly the recovery criteria for wolves is, you know, 3 times 100 was not quantitatively determined. I mean, it was based on expert opinion. And so that probably is not a long-term sustainable minimum viable population. Now, I think one reason it was set so low is wolves are so hard to get in the door, so to speak. You have to have low expectations. You know, what is a biologically restored population is probably much higher. Certainly connectivity is an important aspect. We lost some lawsuits on that. But wolves have a social structure that's very fragile. Their demographics is pretty durable. But their problem is constant human-caused mortality. So they're in a constant rebuilding mode in terms of population status. And so I don't think that's a recovered population. I think that's a minimum population that's sustainable, that's socially acceptable, or a social carrying capacity, but it's not a recovered carrying capacity. And because it was enshrined at 3 times 100, it's going to be really hard to change. Probably a more appropriate level is somewhere between 1,000 to 1,500 wolves in the tri-state area, which we're above now. So everyone is like, what's the problem? Well, the problem is the states are managing towards the floor of that population. It would be better to have the minimum be higher, which would drive up some of the population estimates to be more accurate.
Thanks. So when we talk about numbers of animals, and we talk about surplus animals, and we speak of them like corn that's harvested every year. You, in the last stretch of your career in Yellowstone, you saw quotas, sort of blanket numeric allowances for take applied, and you saw one pack completely obliterated, and you saw two other packs severely impacted. So I want to ask both of you, what is it that we're missing when we don't think about the sentience, in the case of wolves, highly social animals, sophisticated family units? What are we missing, and how did that make you feel being on the front end, front lines watching this happen, the animals you'd study for a quarter century?
Well, I mean, that's what got me interested in wolves to begin with. I really do believe they are symbols of the wild, and we could debate all night what that means. But part of that is their sentience. They're a living, feeling, breathing critter that, you know, deserves respect. And what attracted me to them is we have never treated them that way. I mean, they were considered vermin. People hate them. They, you know, cut off their lower jaws and turned them loose. They put razor blades and nails in chunks of meat. And these were ways to kill them. These are all age-old practices. And for human beings to do that to another creature really caught my attention early on. And that's one reason I feel fortunate to have the career I did, because I work for the U.S. National Park Service, whose objective is to preserve and protect, very simply put. Visitor enjoyment's also part of it, but that was a privilege to uphold and maintain. And so to bring wolves back after the Park Service had eliminated them, and to bring them back and to fight that opposition, that political opposition, that public opposition, was very difficult. And what's happened is that still has not gone away. And it's that, I have to say, it's that look to a wolf's eyes where you get that sentient feeling. And so what bothers me the most about management in this region, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, seeping into Washington, Oregon, and now California, is they're still treated as, kill as many as you want and they'll bounce back. They'll be fine. They can live next to people. And that is true. But they're not the same animal when we treat them that way. And so what I'm trying to say is I acknowledge that living with wolves is difficult. So let's find solutions to those problems, but let's still, while we still can, before the West is not completely taken over by humans, which at the rate that that slide showed, it is, but let's get those places, maybe they'll self-select, they're usually public lands, where conflict is low with these native carnivores, wolves, grizzly bears, cougars, and let's actively manage in favor of that. I think that's one solution. I'm not saying it's the only solution. The word for it is zonal management. I mentioned it in my talk. They're doing a little bit of that in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan. But what that's basically saying is aggressively protecting some areas for these hard-to-live-with species that aren't necessarily national parks. Because I know the pushback I'll get right away. We have Yellowstone, we have Glacier, we have Central Idaho. I think we need to have more than that. And by doing that, we're respecting coexistence with other life forms that are difficult to live with. And that comes to your question of sentience. Look into a wolf's eyes, look into a grizzly's eyes, and you'll get what I mean. We've got to respect that. We're headed in a direction where we're not.
We've known each other a long time, and during our first conversations, you would often say we manage for populations of bears because the point of recovery was that. But I've watched your thinking evolve over the years for you to appreciate sentience, to appreciate the value of individual bears, a bear like Jackson Hole Grizzly 399, 28 years old, 18 cubs, maybe two dozen animals in her bloodline, one animal. What is it that you appreciate about the sentience of grizzly bears?
Well, grizzly bears are long-lived, and they learn as they live. A lot of the film that you watched here was social marking behavior, where bears are listening and smelling for the presence of their fellows and marking trees to present their presence to their fellows. They have a complex social system. They have a culture that they pass on to their young. They have this complex system of life that has allowed them to do what they do. And it's important to realize that we don't have conflicts with the vast majority of grizzly bears or the vast majority of wolves. Most of the wolves and the grizzly bears get along without any conflicts with humans at all. And yet this demonization of these animals is based on this barroom biology approach that, you know, wolves are going to eat all the elk and they're going to put the cattle industry out of business. And in Wyoming, you can kill wolves with snow machines. And this was just legalized by the Wyoming legislature, officially legalized, even though these wolves are not in any conflict at all. They just happen to be living in a place, and they can be killed, even though they're not in any conflict. Doug and I are fully in agreement that, you know, we need to remove animals that are in conflicts with people, but the vast majority of them are not. And we need to respect these animals as sentient beings and animals that have a complex culture and a social system that lives beside us. And we need to treat them with respect. They are not a burden. They are not an inconvenience. They are a responsibility that we need to treat very carefully.
I want to follow. I want to follow up with this and talk a bit about Wyoming refusing to ban running over snowmobiles or wolves with snowmobiles. You were in favor of delisting in the first two rounds, and you've switched, which is a really big deal for the Federal Grizzly Bear Recovery Coordinator for 35 years doing that, and you had developed great contacts with the states. And also, we've seen sprawl sweeping into the valleys and creating conflict zones. What is it about that action with wolves in Wyoming? How does that land on you with regard to thinking about their stewardship of grizzly bears?
Well, I think we need to recognize that the problem that exists now is that politicians are making wildlife biology decisions based on barroom biology and nonsense. And for 30 of the 35 years that I was the recovery coordinator, the states managed bears and wolves based on science and facts. And I have complete respect for the state biologists who do a heck of a job and are still trying to do a heck of a job under the administrations that exist in these states. But what's happened is that politicians are now making decisions on wildlife based on their hatred of predators, based on their feeling that these animals are a burden and they're dangerous and all this kind of stuff. And the legislatures are passing specific laws on how many animals should be killed and how they should be killed. All these things that Doug talked about, you know, that you can shoot wolves over bait at night, that was put in place by the legislature. Hound hunting black bears and grizzly bear habitat, that's from the legislature. Paying people to kill wolves, that's from the legislature. It's not from the biologists in the biological departments of the fish and game agencies. And so this evolution, which didn't exist until about 8 or 10 years ago, where the politicians are deeply involved in aggressive management against predators, is what turned my opinion against. I don't think that the states are capable of managing these species anymore, not because the biologists are not capable. They are. It's because the politicians have superseded the biologists, and they're making the decision.
Just for the record, how many people do you know who have ever been eaten by a wolf?
I don't know any.
Okay. You and I have both spent time in the upper Midwest, in Minnesota. Why aren't Minnesotans crazy when it comes to wolves? Why they seem to be living with them? 3,000 wolves, the largest population of any state in a region with 12,000 farms. What is it? What's the cultural difference between there and the Midwest? In the Midwest?
That's a deep answer. There's many ways you can answer it. There's probably no right answer. But right off the bat, I was in Minnesota last week, and wolves are still controversial in Minnesota. I mean, you go to rural Minnesota, and you get wolf hatred, and you get wolf lovers, and it's split just like across here. It might be a little less vitriolic because wolves are never completely gone. So, you know, you had the reality of wolves all the time. And so the tall tales and the, you know, one thing I like to say is you have to study wolves because if you don't study them and don't know about them, people will make stuff up about them. And, you know, a little less of that goes on in places where wolves were never eliminated from. You know, wolves have always been common, relatively common in Canada and Alaska. There's still people who want to kill them all in those places as well. So it's, you know, wolves have a lot of cultural baggage. How you feel about wolves is usually determined by your values. The level of wolf hatred does wax and wane. I think it's a little less in the Midwest because they've lived with them longer and they have a little less of the frontier individualistic attitude. You know, folks in the West take great pride on living off the land, living without government interference. You know, in Minnesota, sure, you'll find that too. It's everywhere. But people are a little bit more used to living with other people, which means you're going to have to make amends and sacrifices to get along, which means regulations. And, you know, so we need to live with wildlife. We need to have more, you know, you say the word, I almost didn't say the word regulation in this auditorium because you can't say it in the West, you know. It's just, that's a non-starter. But I think that's part of it is the culture's different. The frontier attitude's different. Wolves have always been there. But can you find pockets of extreme wolf hatred in Minnesota? Sure. Every place wolves are. And that's the unfortunate side of humanity that I really, you know, I have a hard time understanding. How can we not progress past that one day and have these middle-of-the-road reasonable populations? Sure, if wolves' populations are getting too high, bear populations, there are wildlife management techniques to deal with that in a reasonable way. We're not headed towards that. We're headed away from that.
Chris, this is a question for you. The questioner asks, is Montana going to create wildlife overpasses so grizzly populations can gain greater genetic diversity? Would you talk about connectivity and genetic diversity? The state here recently transplanted a bear to enhance it. But would you also, since we've all read a lot about wildlife overpasses and underpasses, bridges, of what their positive usefulness is, but also what their limitations are pertaining to habitat?
Well, it's a good idea to think we want to get animals across highways, particularly interstate highways where there's lots of traffic. And for animals to move across the landscape and be interconnected is genetically and demographically healthy for these populations. That's a good thing. But you can invest $20 million in a fancy overpass, you know, which has trees planted on it and things like that, and get the highway addressed. That's with highway money, which is going to be right next to the highway. But if both ends of that overpass are being subdivided, like you saw in this picture here, then it's a bridge to nowhere. And we're not getting them anywhere because no animals will ever get to those bridges. So I think it's, you know, it's a great idea to think about overpasses, but it's not the solution. The solution is a complex effort that looks at intact landscapes so that the animals can move that looks at working with the communities that live in these intervening areas to help them minimize conflicts with bears and wolves so the animals can move across the landscape and not get into trouble with livestock or garbage or whatever. And where you have a highway, you address what's at both ends of those potential crossing places so that we don't get subdivisions and high density housing in places like that that completely negates the effect of a $25 million overpass. The overpass isn't going to do it by itself.
Doug, this is a question for you. Someone wants to know, what do you think about relisting wolves in the Northern Rockies? Where do you come down on that? And if not relisting, what's the best sort of management scenario?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. So it gets back to this kind of anti-government attitude. It's wolves had a status review of about a year ago. And what a status review is wolves were delisted. The requirement was 100 wolves in each state, as I mentioned. But as Chris said, the other first criteria for delisting, not recovery, as Chris eloquently pointed out, is minimum population size, and every recovery plan usually has that. And then the second thing is adequate regulatory mechanism, which the states will exhibit for delisting. And when all of these rules went into place that we have pointed out, I won't repeat them, Chris and I have mentioned them, the Fish and Wildlife Service implemented a status review. And what a status review is, a look at to see if your population is high enough as when they were delisted and to see if there was, if you're adhering to adequate regulatory mechanism. And that was the real sticking point that the Fish and Wildlife Service did because, night hunting, baiting, high quotas, bounties, all these different things doesn't look like it's the adequate regulatory mechanism at all. So they initiated a status review. That's essentially, in slang terms, a shot across the state's bows. And they took a couple years to do it. They determined that there were enough wolves that didn't warrant delisting, so they decided not to do it. But the point was, it got the Fish and Wildlife Service's attention that all of these regulations that we have showcased were implemented. And they've stayed in place. During that process, I was asked to sign on a letter to the Secretary of the Interior requesting relisting. I did not do that because some of my state colleagues that I have a lot of respect for, as Chris said, he does too, said relisting would really set wolf recovery back because it would remove local control of wolves. And then the big bad federal government would come in and take over again, which a lot of people resent. And this is particularly true in Wyoming. Now, Wyoming, a lot of people have trouble with because 85% of the state is a predator zone. And this is where this whacking event with the snowmobile occurred. But wolves there, 15% of the state, wolves are managed as a trophy game animal. And that combination of practices has kind of taken wolves from white hot controversial and brought their temperature down to just medium hot. And colleagues of mine in Wyoming said if they're relisted, it's going to turn them right back to white hot. This would really set wildlife management back. Idaho and Montana have been less good. So interestingly, Wyoming at the beginning, a lot of people thought had the worst management plan, but they haven't changed it much since. But Idaho and Montana, which was thought to have better plans, have changed it drastically. So now it's thought that Wyoming's plan, well, they're looking pretty good now, but Idaho and Montana are the problems, and they should not be rewarded for those management practices. So having said all of that, I do think for the moment what I would like to work on is trying to get some of these draconian regulations in Idaho and Montana changed so we can get back on course to reasonable wildlife management. If we took control away from the states, there would be a backlash. There would be an anti-government wave. There would be all kinds of problems just based on get the federal government out of my life, out of wildlife management. And I still think given, and I realize the victories weren't much, I admit that, but the commissioners were very reasonable. They wanted to hear from people. They were open to change. My mood is to try and give that a little bit more time. It's key who the commissioners are. You guys reaching out to them and asking for these practices is more aligned, I think, with helping at least wolves. Chris and I often speak in unison. This is one thing I'm just going to stick to wolves on. But once they're relisted, that angers a lot of people. In a lot of ways, they should be relisted based on what Idaho and Montana has done. They have not done a great job for political reasons. This is very hard for me to say. Colleagues of mine disagree. Terrible job with wolves. Don't let them get on with it. But based on some of my face-to-face, one-on-one interactions with commissioners, for example, I want to try and work through this. You folks need to help. I guess that's my answer. Tough question.
Chris, I want to ask you a question, and I want the audience to sort of share this question. There's a premise out there that we recover species, some species at least, in order to hunt them again. And there is this perception that we bring grizzly bears back to hunt. What the public may not realize is that bald eagles kill more livestock nationwide than wolves and grizzly bears do in a given year. And we've brought bald eagles back, and one could hunt them as trophies. And there are 100 times more, maybe 1,000 times more bald eagles on the landscape. And yet we delisted them from the Endangered Species Act, and we still protect them under the Bald Eagle Act and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. What do you think about being able to proclaim victory and say, the Endangered Species Act succeeded in bringing them back, but simultaneously move bears under, say, a Grizzly Bear Recovery Act and keep them protected?
Well, that's been proposed. And, you know, grizzly bears are very, very sensitive species. As Doug said, they can't take a lot of mortality. They can be easily reduced in numbers. They're not resilient at all to excessive mortality. They do not need to be hunted to be managed. We can have grizzly bear populations quite healthy without any hunting. British Columbia eliminated hunting in 2017. There's 14,000 grizzly bears in British Columbia. It's not an issue. I think it would be an interesting approach that, you know, grizzly bears are special enough and they live in a small enough an area that rather than turning them over to complete state control, that you have some kind of a special Grizzly Bear Management Act, similar to the Bald Eagle Act, in which they would be managed under. I've never, you know, formally proposed that or worked on any such thing, but I think there's some merit in considering that. Let me ask you a question, Todd. You know, in this graphic that showed all those dots increasing across the landscape, this is a huge issue, everybody. It's not just killing grizzly bears and wolves. It's all of us moving into Montana. What do you think could be done to address that issue, Todd? Simple question.
So one of the laments about journalists is that we identify problems, but we don't identify solutions. So I would do 3 things. One is, if there are business people out there, you all know that you can't operate your business without a business plan. Counties, we can't manage growth without a plan and without enforceable zoning. There's never been an ecosystem like Greater Yellowstone protected without zoning. Zoning that would protect key wildlife habitat on the landscape. So that's one thing, and that's informed by experts that I interviewed. The second thing is, we all know how rapid things change during COVID. Things accelerated, both the human footprint in our valleys, outdoor recreation. Kathy Whitlock did a great climate change study that confirmed a lot of things. So what people have told me is they would implement a real estate transfer tax. Most people moving here who can afford to buy properties could afford a 1% tax. Over time, you would create, well, let me throw this out, $12 billion in real estate changed hands between Jackson, Teton Valley, Idaho, Big Sky, and Gallatin County since COVID. $12 billion. So if you had a 1% tax, you could create a war chest, you could compensate farmers and ranchers and keep them on the land, incentivize them, help local land trusts. You could incentivize zoning so that it's not punitive. And you could also pour money into affordable housing, which is a huge problem, as we all know. People who care and don't have means shouldn't be priced out of this place. And then the third thing is a backpack tax. These two guys are lifelong hunters, and for the hunters and anglers, whenever you buy hunting or fishing gear, you pay an excise tax, and that money goes back into habitat protection. If you buy a duck stamp, it goes to protect national wildlife refuges. Hunting is on the decline in the United States. Whether you like hunting or not, it doesn't matter, but number of hunters is going down every year. And so less dollars are being generated for that. If we had a backpack tax, again, tens of millions of dollars could be generated. We could put it to all those things that I just mentioned. The problem is that the outdoor retail industry that's pushing industrial strength outdoor recreation refuses to accept a modest tax. So if you go out and you buy a jacket for $200, it might be a $2 tax. You buy skis, it might be $20. So those things, we could solve a lot of problems with more money coming in. And, you know, we have 10 million visitors coming to Montana, what economists call free riders. And we're paying for the services for them to come here, and we're not taxing them. And I'll just say it's a fact. The state legislatures have hobbled the ability of local citizens to go to the polls, and if they choose, tax themselves or tax outsiders. So I'm going to come out and carry this out if anybody has any questions, because what we really want to do is hear from you. So if you have a question, could you raise your hand and we'll get a mic to you? Anybody have a question?
There's one over here, Tom. Do you think that humans might self-extirpate before the macrofauna do? Or we extirpate the macrofauna?
I don't know. We could have one big event that would really eliminate pretty much all of us, you know. We have the ability to do that. I don't know. You know, climate change is something that we're driving, and it's certainly affecting all of nature, everything out there. So, you know, we're having a big effect on everything. Not only are we living here, but we're changing the temperature of the atmosphere and the snow conditions and things. So, yeah, we're having big effects. I don't know which would be first or what would be worse. So.
I mean, quickly, because there's a lot of questions. Wolves are a generalist. They're very adaptable. They have one of the widest distributions of any mammal in the world. We could use that to our advantage. They're going to survive a lot of stuff moving forward because they're so adaptable. And so that's something to think about in terms of wolf biology that we could use creatively.
Any other questions?
That's okay. I don't really need
okay.
a microphone.
Go for it.
This is a two-parter, hopefully a little bit more lighthearted than the previous question. First part is for Doug. You mentioned telemetry before in your presentation. For those in the audience who might not know, could you explain what that is and why it's so bad? And then, Chris, you mentioned the distinct populations of grizzlies between the Continental Divide and the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem and how you're tracking the genetic intermixing of those populations. I'm wondering, if in isolation they developed any specific features or behaviors between those populations that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, quickly, telemetry refers to putting radio transmitters on grizzly bears and wolves, other wildlife, birds, mammals, all kinds of wildlife, where devices that can be tracked. And it's a way to learn about them so we can advance science for science's sake, which I think oftentimes leads to other discoveries, but more practically allows you to make good management decisions. So telemetry is an overarching statement that applies to marking animals so you can track them remotely. You can mark an animal with an ear tag or a band and follow it, but that's hard to do. And, you know, that was a big issue in Yellowstone and all national parks. It's a debate that actually I agree with both sides on. I was criticized roundly for many years. Why are you flying helicopters around catching, 20 to 25 wolves every year? I thought national parks were to leave animals alone. I actually agree with that philosophy. However, the flip side, at least in the case of wolves, there's other wildlife species that are collared in national parks. But it's this information void thing that I spoke to earlier. If you don't know about an animal, people will make stuff up about it. And so, the misinformation that occurs in our society today, it's rampant in every walk of life, but especially wolves. And if you don't have hard data on it, even if you do have hard data on them and you cram that data down people's throats, they're still going to believe whatever they want. And so, especially wolves. And so misinformation with wolves is a huge problem. Yellowstone, we had a great opportunity to learn about wolves in ways that few others had access to. So I was in support of continuing to radio collar wolves in Yellowstone. Across the state, wolves are collared for other reasons, mostly livestock problems. And so those collars were used to track them, to find them, to hunt them. And so that was just made illegal by the Fish and Wildlife Commission in Montana. To me, that's another one of those low-hanging fruit things. This is not fair chase hunting. Against the North American Model of Wildlife Management, that's the state's, that's enshrined. So that's what I was talking about. Thank you for making me clarify. Yeah.
So your question about whether they're unique in the Yellowstone or the other ecosystems, not really. We don't see much difference between them. I mean, they eat moths. There's bears that eat fish in the Yellowstone system. Nobody else does because there's fish available in Yellowstone and Yellowstone Lake. We don't see anything unique. Genetically, we can tell each of those populations. And so every bear that's captured, we can tell where it came from genetically because they're genetically unique. And so when a bear does move into Yellowstone and successfully reproduces, we'll see a hybrid bear that is part NCDE bear and part Yellowstone bear, and we'll be able to tell that genetically. That's a hugely powerful tool that really helps us. So genetically is the only thing that's unique about them right now. And eventually, if they all merge, it won't be unique anymore.
Does anybody else have a question? Chris, I want to pose one as I bring the mic down here. You mentioned today about habituated bears and the huge problem that Yellowstone was in, how serious it was that it was. Could you riff a little bit on that of how many food-addicted bears, and there really weren't many bears out there that were not addicted, and what your concerns were and how you thought the population might wink out?
Well, when I started this job, when I was an undergraduate, I worked for John Craig at the University of Montana, so I go way back, and when he was working in Yellowstone. And then when I started this job, looking at what was on the landscape and how many bears were out there, there were probably less than 400 bears. And in Yellowstone, the population may have been as low as 150, 175 bears. And almost all those bears were in the park. And up until 1967, the Park Service provided garbage for bears in the national parks. Everybody knows that now. And every bear, basically, in the national park was probably eating garbage. And then in 1967, two women were killed on the same night in Glacier Park. different places by different grizzly bears. Both of those bears were also eating garbage because they fed bears to garbage in Glacier. Or excuse me, garbage to bears in Glacier. And when the Park Service decided they were going to stop feeding, you know, they were going to close the dumps and eliminate this garbage food, this was a really difficult time for bears. And there were 70 to 80 bears a year in the late 60s and early 70s that died that we just knew about. There were lots of others that we never knew about. And the question when I started the job in 1981 was, where are we actually going to be able to recover grizzly bears? And in 1982, we came to the realization there were probably as few as 30 adult females in the Yellowstone ecosystem, and that those bears were going down. They were disappearing. And we were likely going to lose grizzly bears in Yellowstone. And that information taken back to Washington, D.C., got a lot of people in Washington thinking they didn't want grizzly bears in Yellowstone to go extinct on their watch. And it was really close. And it took a while for these bears to begin to feed on natural foods as they closed the dumps. And there was a big question of whether they could actually do it. Because most of the time when we say bears are eating garbage, we say a fed bear is a dead bear. And all those dumps were closed, and all those bears that ate all that garbage had nothing to do at that point. And they had to try to figure out how to make a living. Most of them didn't do it, and they died. And miraculously, we got through that bottleneck. And so we have a totally wild population in Yellowstone right now. But we went through a real narrow period there after the closure of the dumps in which it was really iffy as to whether we would still have grizzly bears in the Yellowstone system. And that was as short a time ago as the early 80s. So, you know, realize that. Realize there were no grizzly bears in Grand Teton National Park. In the whole Jackson Valley, there were no grizzly bears down there at that time, in the early 80s up into the 90s. Occasionally a bear would show up in there, but there were no resident bears in there. And that's how close we came to losing grizzly bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem. And it was only because of the Endangered Species Act that we have all the grizzly bears we have today in the Yellowstone system, 1,100 grizzly bears. And we came really close to losing them. We don't want to do it again.
Okay, I scored the mic from Todd here. I'd like to commend both of you guys for making such bold statements about the state of wildlife in current times. And I've always argued that our state game agencies have been strapped by the higher-ups, the legislature, places like that. And I think I heard both of you guys say you had little confidence in these state game agencies to do the right thing when no one was watching. So could you maybe share a few thoughts on what you think we as citizens of Montana need to do to coexist with bears and wolves, and what the legislature and the state game agency needs to change to make things better for wolves and bears in the future?
Let me just make a quick answer on this, Doug. We didn't say that the state fish and game agencies are not going to do the right thing. If left to their own devices, the biologists and the scientists and the professionals in the game agencies are going to make the right decisions. We're real satisfied with those guys. What happens is that certain governors get in place and they appoint administrators of those agencies who then put the clamps on the biologists so they can't speak and they can't do the right thing, and the legislatures and the governors start making wildlife policy. That's the risky thing that's happening. So,
yeah, I think I heard exactly what you just said.
Okay. So could you repeat your question again? Go ahead, Doug.
I think the question really is, as citizens of Montana, how do the citizens of Montana need to, you know, react and do the right thing to preserve grizzly bears and wolves? And what does the legislature and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks need to do to kind of change the way they're doing business to make it work? Because I'm not sure all of the citizens of Montana understand exactly what you just said.
I guess my turn. I also know this guy, so he's a plant in the audience. So I won't mention his name just to protect him. You know, I was a government employee with you for a long time, and we did everything we could to do the best job we could that, you know, we thought we were doing. And, you know, I didn't show up for stuff like this a lot, you know, and I think that was a mistake. Sometimes you hid amidst the bureaucracy because, you know, you weren't rewarded for sticking your neck out. And it wasn't always that way for me. You know, when I started out early, I don't go back as long as Chris. I'm not trying to, yeah. But
I'm not as old as I look.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you were allowed to speak out a little bit more, and that kind of went away. Things became more orchestrated. Things became more risk-averse, more layers of approval. For a quick example, press releases when I started off at Yellowstone were approved at the park level. Now they're approved in Washington, D.C. And that one gums everything up. It slows it down. It weakens. It dilutes. And I think that's part of the problem is folks like us became, our voices became diminished. So that's the first part of my answer to you. The second is, and you know, so I was complicit with not showing up a lot because of whatever I just said. But the second, and I guess this is my major message to all of you, is, you know, I was not able to speak directly to Fish and Wildlife commissioners when I worked for the Park Service. I did, but I had to get approval, and it took a while, and it took a lot of debate. Now I can pick the phone up as a citizen and talk directly to them. That's a right you've always had. That was a right I had to get permission for. And it's almost liberating now to be able to pick the phone up or take an email without approval and go directly to them. And I have found it to be profitable. I have found them to be professional and listening. They talk about trying to follow the science. Theoretically, and this could be another issue, they're supposed to be independent from the state biologists. So FWP is over here. You have state biologists working. They make recommendations to the commissioners, but the commissioners are designed to be independent. Most states are set up that way so they can make good decisions with review, with criticism, critical thinking, that kind of thing. And I think they need to hear more from you because they're responsive to that. The people they're hearing from are the angry ones, the people who hate wolves. Not, and I'm not saying you have to like wolves, but you're fighting for reasonability. You're fighting for scientific wildlife management. I know everybody's time limited nowadays, but just even quick emails, phone calls, that's the best answer I can come up with, sir, whose name I won't say in public. But also, I got to say, again, I know it's not like a broken record, you're the voice for wildlife. And one of the best voices is to vote. Vote your conscience, for crying out loud. I'm not going to tell you how to vote, but this place is great. We've got to have politicians who cherish it, love it, and want to manage it the way we used to manage it. You know, Montana wildlife management used to be respected worldwide. I hear murmurs now, it's not anymore, because it's got to go through the governor's office, or it's got to be sought approval. You control that too. So that's two things. I know it sounds back in the old days, but that's using your voice. That's using democracy. Speak out. Write op-eds to the paper. You know, when I was a government employee and had to get approval to do everything, I wrote letters to the editor on different subjects, you know, that didn't have to go through the approval process. Dash a letter off, you know. I know that might not be a great answer, but it's the best answer, Mr. X government bureaucrat.
Vote. Go out and vote. Because this all starts with your vote. And the reason we're in the situation we're in is because of the vote and who got elected. And it doesn't take rocket science to figure this out. It was never this way until that election. in 2020 or whenever it was. And this crazy situation we're in is because of what happened with that vote. And, you know, there are people in charge who are appointing people to run Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and Idaho Fish and Game and Wyoming Game and Fish who think that these animals are a burden and thinks that these animals are not worthy of being around and really don't want to talk about grizzly bears and wolves and would rather have them as minimal numbers in places where they don't have to worry about them. They're what makes Montana what Montana is because they're here today. And we want to keep them here today and healthy. And it all comes down to your vote. We can speak up here, but we only have two votes. Vote and tell everybody you know to vote and make sure you do.
Okay, we're going to have one more question, and let's have it a doozy.
So, Chris, I know that Martha Williams of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is supposed to be releasing a decision concerning grizzly bear delisting in January, is what I read. Have you talked to her? Do you have any inside information about what she's thinking, or do you have trust in her to make the right decision? I would really value your comments.
I know Martha Williams. I knew her before she was director of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. I do not know what she's going to do for a decision. She has not shared that with me. I have been very open with her in expressing the things that I've said tonight, that it is not legitimate to turn grizzly bears over to the state of Montana because I fear that they would do to grizzly bears what they're currently trying to do to wolves. And I don't think that's right. So she knows very well what I think. And what decision she will make, I don't know. And remember when that decision will be, it will be January. And that will be after an election. And again, vote. Because if that election goes the wrong way, then the things we're talking about tonight will be gone. You can pretty much assure yourselves that wolves and grizzly bears will be on the decline from then on in the Rocky Mountain West, and we may get little island populations in the national parks, and that would be about it. And I don't mean to be an alarmist here, but I'm being very serious, because if that election goes wrong, all bets are off for the future of animals like grizzly bears and wolves.
Just a follow-up. What about Deb Haaland? Would she be able to overrule Martha Williams?
Well, they would definitely talk about it. Martha Williams won't make that decision in a vacuum. That decision will be a big decision that is, you know, it'll come through the administration, the Secretary of Interior, the White House will be involved in it because this is a really big deal. Grizzly bears are a really big deal. I don't know what she's going to do. And I think she could make the right decision, and she could do that. But I do not know. I honestly do not know what her decision is going to be. But I've made it quite clear to her what I think and why. And so she knows what my opinion is and many other people's opinion that think like me. So
it was a great evening. So before we leave tonight, I just have a couple of things I wanted to say. Doug and Chris will be out in the lobby to answer a couple of more questions if any of you guys are really ready to ask something you didn't get a chance to. And the other thing that I wanted to let you know is that we have two fine art posters that we're giving away tonight, one of a grizzly and one of a wolf, that is at the Yellowstone table. You'll know it because it's very understated and they're just the posters. And you can also meet Gus O'Keefe at the table. So please stop in and get a poster. All right. Well, let's give them a hand for this.
Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you for coming.
That lecture, The Future of Grizzlies and Wolves in Montana, by Dr. Chris Servine and Dr. Doug Smith, moderated by Todd Wilkinson, again was held at the Emerson Cultural Center in Bozeman on Friday, October 18th of 2024.